Well, thank you. It's an honor and a privilege to be able to address you here today. And on behalf of the National Research Council and the people of Canada, greetings. This is my first presentation from text in a very long time, so I hope that you'll be forgiving. I am by vocation a learning technologist, a researcher, a sometime programmer, a speaker and writer, and a passionate believer in the value and importance of education. I am by education a writer and philosopher, as much a student of Wittgenstein as of Piaget, as much of Descartes as of Dewey. I am indeed lucky that by this time in my life, my pleasures have become my pursuits. I often tell people I do for a living what I would do for fun in my free time, if I had any. As I prepared for this talk in my mind, because nothing really would translate into writing, I prepared for this talk by giving a series of other talks across Australia, traveling from the Top End to Tassie, from the Red Centre to the Barrier Reef. I talked about learning standards and learning object metadata, learning management systems, content management systems, the new student and old traditions, the affordances of technology, barriers to learning, open source and open access, knowledge management, knowledge generation, language, literature, and new media. I wasn't so much speaking as listening, not so much showing as searching. I am a student of learning technology, but learning technology for me is becoming increasingly empty. I don't know if I found what I was looking for, but I did find this, nailed to the wall of a wooden building on the west coast of Tasmania. If we can revise our attitudes towards the land under our feet, if we can accept the role of steward and depart from the role of conqueror, if we can accept the view that man and nature are inseparable parts of the unified whole, then Tasmania can be a shining beacon in a dull, uniform, and largely artificial world. In 1971, I was in grade 7, in a dull, uniform, and largely artificial world. And possibly at the very time these words were written, organizing my fellow students as we stood in a line to enter the class, to put our hands on our heads and make clanking sounds like chains, the condemned. I do not regret my stint in the principal's office for what was, after all, a political crime. But as I stood before this building in the wind and in the rain in Strawn, waiting for my bus, I realized that we have been and are doing the same thing to ourselves as we have to the trees in the forests. And the same thing that will save Tasmania will save me. In 1995 or so, I found myself working for Assiniboine Community College in Brandon, Manitoba, a small city of 40,000 people on the wheat fields of Western Canada, working, on the one hand, to prepare college materials for distance delivery, and on the other hand, to prepare the college and the community for the advantages the internet would offer the world of learning. At Assiniboine, I built a learning management system, something we called OLE, short for Online Learning Environment, a computer program designed for the World Wide Web that would be like an online learning manual, only better. And I had the idea that units of learning, what we called modules, could be designed in such a way as to be reused in one course or another. Unknown to me, another Canadian, Wayne Hodgins, had the same idea, and instead of calling them modules, he called them learning objects. Hodgins explained, "My journey into the world of learning objects started with an epiphany moment, watching my children play with Lego blocks many years ago. I began what has been more than 10 years of refining a dream of a world where all content exists at just the right and lowest possible size, much like the individual blocks that make up the Lego system." Well, this early vision has undergone numerous changes since its inception, but though the concept has remained the same. Learning objects are small bits of reusable digital content that can be used to support learning. How they fit together has become terribly important, and so there's been much debate about the correct analogy to use. So learning objects with us, more like atoms, for example. Or there should be things like data objects and knowledge objects, which would instead be combined to form shareable courseware objects. Hodgins himself abandoned the Lego metaphor, recommending instead what he called a multi-level content taxonomy. Well, the idea caught the attention of the educational community. And so while I was still at Assiniboine, the first draft of the influential IMS metadata specification, describing the concept of a learning object in exquisite detail, landed on my desk with a thud. I printed it out and enthusiastically showed it to my colleagues and said, this is what the next version of Olé is going to have to conform to. And they looked at the inch-thick document and they said, something I will loosely translate as, you've got to be kidding. Despite the initial skepticism, I was convinced. And while I never did program an IMS-compatible version of Olé, the idea, it seemed to me, was sound. And when a few years later at the University of Alberta I wrote a paper called Learning Objects, I had in my mind already well rehearsed the argument in favor of reusable digital content. It made no sense, I argued, to produce the same module in trigonometry or Shakespeare over and over again. The principles of mathematics and the language of literature were quite unlikely to change one year to the next. For a while there, I was completely in sync with the rest of the world. My paper was at the top of the Google listings for learning objects. And it had become apparent, not only to myself, but to the rest of the education technology, that learning objects would have wide applicability, not only in distance learning, but in learning in general. And it became apparent, not only to myself, but to the community as a whole, that the use of web-based materials would change the nature of teaching itself. As the old saying goes, become a guide by the side instead of a sage on the stage. I had this vision, you see, that the use of learning objects would, in effect, make learning content seamlessly and effortlessly available not only to all students, but to all people in the world who wish to learn. And that the portability and reusability of learning objects meant that we could develop an educational environment where students were not marched in lockstep through a predefined curriculum, but instead could have the freedom and the capacity to explore the world of learning according to their own interests and their own whims. Learning, genuinely free and accessible learning, could be produced and shared by all. I may have been in sync with the rest of the world, but it would not last long. While I was thinking of what the educational system could become, the network of publishers and software developers and educational institutions that developed around the concept of learning objects had a very different idea. Here's what it would be. Learning resources would be authored by instructors, or more likely, publishing companies, organized using sequencing or learning design, assigned digital rights and licenses, packaged, compressed, encrypted, and stored in an institutional repository. They would be searched for, located, and retrieved through something called a federated search system, retrieved and stored locally in something called a learning content management system. When needed, they would be unpacked and displayed to the student, a student who, using the learning management system, would follow the directions set out by a learning designer, work his or her way through the material, maybe do a quiz, maybe participate in a course-based discussion. That's the picture. That's the brave new world of online learning. And honestly, it seems to me, at every point where they could have got it wrong, they did. And though I don't have a lot of time, I'm going to linger here a bit and draw out a few features of today's online learning. Not just to show where they're wrong, although there's a certain pleasure in this, but to analyze why I think it went wrong, and therefore, where I think we ought to go instead. I don't have time in today's short talk to look at everything, but a look at three aspects of the new system should be enough to prove the point. Content packaging, federated search, and learning design. Educational content has long been the domain of the publication industry. And while perhaps some professors felt that the new technology might result in a new type of publication, it is equally true that existing publishers believed that they had discovered new markets. It is no coincidence that one of the earliest entrants into the field of learning objects, NetG, which introduced NetG learning objects, is owned by Thomson Publishing. Learning object metadata has been formalized by IEEE as 1482.12.1 learning object metadata, and adapted by the U.S. military as a requirement for all providers as a standard called SCORM, or the Shareable Courseware Object Reference Model. In order to satisfy the needs of the publishing industry, the second specification undertaken by IMS was something called content packaging. The analogy between the digital package and, say, a book or a magazine is deliberate and obvious. In this model, groups of learning objects are assembled to form courseware. This courseware is packed and compressed, or zipped, and then sold as a bundle to an educational institution, where it is loaded onto a learning content management system to be routed for delivery to the student on a learning management system. From my perspective, this model is about as far from the model of the internet as one can get and still be in the realm of digital content. It resembles much more a school library or a CD collection than it does the World Wide Web. It also resembles the way publishing companies view the sale of digital journal subscriptions and e-books as prepackaged content, the use of which is tightly controlled, or software complete with encryption and registration that has to be licensed in order to be used, and requires that it be in close interaction with an operating system, in this case, the LMS, and to be installed. And of course, without the LMS, the learning content is effectively useless. You can't just view it on your web browser. From my perspective, if online learning held the promise of reducing the cost of learning materials and opening access to all, this model effectively took it away. Even for educational institutions, the cost of entry is the purchase of an LMS or an LCMS. And although content could, in theory, be authored by school or college staff, the requirements of metadata, packaging, and compressing entails the use of expensive authoring tools, tools that are not available anyways. There is, moreover, no effective way to share learning content with other institutions. No such thing as a web of learning objects. No such thing as Google to help instructors find them. It is quite literally a separate internet, and one that is more likely to become more separate still. Now, because learning objects are invisible to Google, there have been several projects designed to make them discoverable. For the last 2 years, I've been involved in one of them, the EduSource project, based in Canada, which has the objective of linking collections of learning objects, known as repositories, to support what is called a federated search. In the e-learning world in general, this has been the next new thing. IMS has released another specification, the Digital Repository Specification. And instead of Google, operators of learning objects and learning content management systems are intended to access these federated searches. Without lingering on this for too long, let me say that a federated search is everything that Google isn't. With Google, information about every website in the world is collected in one place. The user accesses the Google interface and searches for it all at once. In a federated search, the information, in this case the learning object metadata, stays where it is, in individual repositories. When a person conducts the search is sent to each repository separately. Thus, if there are 10 repositories in a federated search network, the same search is conducted 10 times, once in each repository, and then the results are sent back to the searcher. If this process seems odd and cumbersome, it is. In practice, the federated search over even a small number of repositories is significantly slower than Google. It is also exclusive. For in order to be a member of a federated search network, it is necessary that a repository be able to support each instance of every search on the network. It's like requiring that each repository have the capacity of Google. But more importantly, it exercises control over the search results. Because metadata originates only from the source repository, and only at the time of the search, access to the metadata, access to the information about the learning resources, can be blocked, is blocked, if the user does not have the right credentials, doesn't have the license, for example, is accessing from the wrong computer. Moreover, the only information about a learning object to be had is information about that object provided by a vendor. It's like getting your only information about a car or a book from the people who are trying to sell it to you. What Google has that a federated search system by definition cannot have is what I call third-party metadata and what Google calls PageRank. In order to order search results, what Google does, essentially, is collect information about what other people think of the resource and to incorporate that into its search. For example, Google counts the links from other sites to the resource in question. And if many people link to the resource, it is ranked higher. No such ranking is available to searchers in a federated search network. The only ranking possible is that provided by the vendor. And that is rather more likely to have to do with the vendor's business model than any third-party information about quality, classification, usability, or suitability. Now, in a learning management system, learning objects must be displayed to the student. And in the world of learning objects the IMS way, learning is completely contained within the content package. The manner in which these objects are presented to the student is called learning design, and is the subject of yet another IMS specification. Learning design follows from an earlier IMS specification called simple sequencing, and the name of the former suggests the direction of the latter. Learning design has its roots in computer-based training, and is essentially the definition of a set of interactions and activities used to present materials to students based on their responses to things like tests or quizzes. The analogy employed by the designers of learning design is that of the play, where learners take on various roles, and where the learning design document acts itself as a script, the learning management system as the director. In other words, the model has become such that learning objects, insofar as they support learning, must necessarily come with specific learning objectives in order to fit into a learning design. Indeed, the more explicit a learning object is, the more explicit the learning objective is, the better a learning object is, because it can be used explicitly in this or that learning design. But as Wiley argues in his paper, The Reusability Paradox, the more specifically defined the learning objective is, the less reusable the learning object becomes, until you get to the point where a learning object may be used in one and only one learning design. Learning design is, in my opinion, very much a dead end. A dead end not because it results in e-learning that is linear, predictable, and boring, although it is that. A dead end not because it reduces interaction to the state of semi-literate, yes-no, true-false, multiple-choice questions, although it is that. It is a dead end because it is no advantage over the old system. It doesn't take advantage of the online learning environment at all. It just becomes an electronic way to standardize class planning, manual production. It's not cheaper, it's not more flexible, and it's not more accessible. So what went wrong? I mean, it's easy to say that systems are too expensive, the learning too boring, the search too cumbersome, the reusable objects too not reusable. What matters here is that I'd be able to explain why the existing model is inadequate and how it differs from the model that is worth emulating. The one that I've suggested, and now say explicitly, is the model instantiated by the World Wide Web. It has been observed many times that technology evolves in two stages. In the first stage, the new technology emulates previous practice. Thus, for example, when movies were first introduced, they were essentially recordings of stage plays, with a single camera located in the position of the audience. Only later did we get multiple cameras, zooms, fades, different special effects. Similarly, The refrigerator began as the icebox, and only later did we get air conditioning, ice cube makers, and a special device designed to resurface hockey ice rinks known as the Zamboni. Early automobiles were known explicitly as horseless carriages, and only later did we get motor coaches and transports and interstate highways. Online learning has evolved in very much the same way. The learning management system was designed explicitly to emulate traditional practice. The basic unit and structure of instruction remained the course. The basic unit of person remained the class. And for the most part, albeit with new technology, the time-honored techniques of instructional delivery, interaction, and testing were emulated in this new environment. If learning management systems imported anything new to traditional learning, they did so through migration from existing practices and distance learning. Now, we talked earlier about the discussion of a metaphor for learning objects. But the idea of a learning object has drifted far from the idea of learning objects as atoms as you can go, far away from the idea of learning objects as Legos. Indeed, on observation, it could be said that if any metaphor applies to learning objects, it would be that of the word in a sentence, the line in a play. The use of the learning object has become, in practice, not the combining of individual entities, but the arrangement of them. Learning object metadata forming a vocabulary. Learning design creating a syntax. Content packaging assembling them into a book. Federated search acting as a bookstore, or at the very best, interlibrary loan. And if language is the metaphor, then language itself is the problem. For everything that language is, static, linear, structured, ordered, hierarchical, the internet isn't. We are locked in language. We are locked into the structure of language, the ordered, neat idea that language represents. The management, organization, language is plan, language is structure, language is order. The world made neat and tidy. The world made dull, uniform, and largely artificial. We must leave language behind and forge our way towards something new. When I say that we must leave language behind, I mean it quite literally. Language must be replaced. Is in the process of being replaced by a melange of multimedia, of chaotic mixtures of text and symbols, audio and video, of words and images, topics and theses, concepts and criticisms, not neatly stacked into rows and distributed through an orderly process of content management, but blasted aimlessly into an environment, a wall of sound and sensation, not written but presented, not read but perceived. The idea is as audacious as it is breathtaking, but it is happening today. You've probably heard of the concept of the digital immigrant and the digital native. The idea that the digital native, the one who was born with today's electronic technology, the one who got his or her first mobile phone before their first pencil, if they got a pencil at all, the one who is part of, as some characterize it, the MTV generation. The digital native, we are told, operates at Twitch speed, multitasks, quite literally, thinks not in an orderly progression of thought, but in multiple parallel threads, associating seemingly at random, communicating not so much through sentences and paragraphs as through a barrage of images and something like text. It's difficult for us to imagine. But think for a moment of the cave paintings found on the Aboriginal lands here in Australia and in similar dwellings around the world. Why didn't they just write on the wall, "Don't eat the yellow part"? It is, of course, to a significant degree because these cultures were pre-linguistic. If they had a language, it wasn't the sort of thing that was functionally useful, not the sort of thing that they could scrawl on a wall. Written language was invented. And the complex structures and characteristics that followed invented as well. And it began from a sense-based pictorial representation of the world. And if we think about how such people must have thought their thoughts, it must have been quite literally in pictures, the linguistic capacity of speaking to oneself that cognitive theorists are so fond of talking about today, either not used or not existing. It's almost incomprehensible, but it's not beyond comprehension. We can, if we wish, begin to at least understand the language of the digital native, even if we're not able to speak it fluently. We can, as we understand the prehistoric, understand the future by reading the artifacts. What unfolds is not only a new way of understanding the future, but a new way of understanding the world itself. And for us, as educators, a new way of doing what we must, of preserving and propagating the knowledge and the values of the past. And we have to do it right. We only get one chance. Our first artifact is the world of blogging. Jorn Barger's original definition of a weblog reads as follows. A weblog is a web page where a weblogger logs all the other web pages she finds interesting. The format is normally to add the newest entry to the top of the page so that repeat visitors can catch up simply by reading down the page. The weblog format simmered for a few years, growing in popularity but escaping widespread notice until the arrival of a weblogging service called Blogger. Consisting of little more than a title field and a text field, Blogger was simple enough for everyone to use, free and popular. Thus empowered, the format of blogging grew to the point where there are some 4 million blogs published today. If the format is what defines a blog, the author is what defines blogging. The thing about personal publishing is it's irreducibly personal. What makes blogging work is not only its simplicity, but its almost complete lack of restraint on the authors. Bloggers are variously wildly opinionated, or incisive and informed, long and rambling, or short to the point of beyond terse, left-wing, right-wing, anarchist, corporate, or even collective. Blogs are, if nothing else, the voices of the authors. Any order beyond that is coincidence. Blogs today are written in text, but as access improves and better tools are placed into people's hands, we will see more multimedia. Already there are audio blogs and photo blogs. And similarly, blogs are written on the computer today, but this too will change. Already people can send SMS messages or emails to their blogs. They can ring up a number on their mobile phone and dictate to their blogs. Any thought worth recording, and many that are not, is being stored in blog, in whatever format is available at the time. To the post-linguistic, each of these blog entries can be thought of as being like a word in the new language. They are the basic units of thought. They are reflective of a vocabulary that is rich and expressive, subtle and nuanced. They are not ordered in sentences, but are strewn wildly across the internet. Viewed in the aggregate, they appear random, like static, like noise. To return to learning for just a moment, when we think of learning objects, we should be thinking of two things. That learning objects ought most properly to be thought of as though they were blog posts, and that the primary authors or speakers of blog posts will be, must be, the bloggers themselves. We can and should join the conversation, but we cannot control it. Learning objects may be constrained, learning design pre-ordered, their authoring cumbersome, and their distribution controlled. But blogs are the opposite of all this, and that's what makes them work. Now, if I'm going to commit myself to the thesis that blog posts are like the words in a new language, then it's reasonable to ask about the grammar of the new language. And the answer to that question, in my opinion, is found in the underlying structure provided by a type of XML called RSS. Rich Site Summary, or RSS, was a technology created by Netscape. The idea of RSS was that a content provider, such as a newspaper or magazine, could list the new items on its website in a machine-readable XML format so that Netscape's own program could retrieve that listing, a process called harvesting, and use it to design personalized pages in its NetCenter website. Users would create a NetCenter account, and then subscribe to those content providers they wish to read, and in so doing, design their own personal NetCenter page. Well, NetCenter did not, as Netscape had hoped, save the company. And they removed the NetCenter page, and even removed the RSS specification from its website. But there was a group of devotees, one of them being myself, who had taken hold of the idea. And RSS was reborn as an unsanctioned, unsponsored, unfunded, ungoverned, and for the most part, unused branch of XML, living on only in discussion lists that eventually became the syndication or the RSS dev groups on Yahoo Groups. It was to this technology I referred explicitly in 2000 when I wrote my paper Content Syndication and Online Learning, promoting the idea that RSS could be used to syndicate learning resources into an online learning environment. Based on this idea, I built such an environment called Munimal. It was designed as a knowledge, learning, and information resource for the municipal sector in Alberta. Munimal was not a course. It was not structured. It was not ordered. It was, and is, since it's an indispensable part of that community today, an open-ended learning environment, and is probably more like the future of online learning than anything that you'll find in a learning management system like WebCT or Blackboard. RSS is the semantic web. It's not the official semantic web. As I said, it's not sanctioned by any standards body or organization whatsoever. But RSS is what has emerged as the de facto description of online content, used by more than 4 million sites already worldwide and growing rapidly, used to describe not only resources, but people, places, objects, calendar entries, blog posts, and in my way of thinking, learning resources and learning objects. What makes RSS work is that it approaches search a lot more like Google and a lot less like federated search. Metadata moves freely about the internet and is aggregated not by one but by many sources, is recombined and fed forward. Sites like Technorati and Bloglines, Popdex and Blogdigger are just exploring this new potential. RSS is the new syntax, and people using it have found a voice. With this in mind, my own work in recent years has involved the development of semantic networks within the blogging and RSS networks. More specifically, what this means is that I've been using the existing network in order to collect and organize and redistribute information. In a certain sense, what I've been building is the equivalent of an airport hub or a freeway interchange, a place where many strands of the network come together, are reorganized, are redistributed. What I've built is a system called EduRSS, a software program that harvests the RSS feeds from 200 or 300 educational technology blogs, stores the links in a searchable database, and then sorts the links into topics and redistributes the results as a set of topic-specific RSS feeds. Thus, for example, I have on my website a page called Learning Objects that represents, in real time, the collective contributions of several hundred authors, and yet is specific enough that it represents a very concentrated and manageable stream of information for the average reader. Essentially, what EduRSS has become is a specialized content filter. It filters content in two ways. First, it filters content by selectivity. One of the 4 million or so, out of the 4 million or so RSS feeds available, I've selected only a small number, only those relevant to my particular interests. Second, it filters by content. Each item is subjected to a semantical test. In my case, matching it with a regular expression. Only items that match the regular expression are forwarded through the feed. EduRSS also interprets data as it comes in. The world of RSS is unstructured. There's no government. There are no fewer than 9 types of RSS, numerous modifications and extensions, syntactic variations, and more. From this hodgepodge, EduRSS extracts only the information it needs. If information is missing, it supplies its own data. Part of EduRSS, a routine that analyzes mailing lists and creates specialized RSS feeds from these mailing lists, actually constructs part of the RSS file by examining the mailing list data. But for all that, the key to RSS, EduRSS, is specialization. For all its power, it only tries to do this work on a very small part of the internet. It's no Google. It's not trying to be Google. It's nothing more than a single node in a very complex network. What should happen, what is already happening, is that a large network of sites like EduRSS should emerge, forming, in essence, a second layer in the network. The result of this second layer is that the internet will self-organize, that information generated in 1,000 or 1,000,000 places will cluster, become composite, interpreted, specialized, and produce highly targeted, highly specific resource feeds at the output end. It should not be surprising that order emerges from a network of disorganized and disparate sources. Order emerges out of networks. That's how networks work. And that's why this is the grammar of the new language. Order emerges out of networks because networks are not static. And they're not organized, but instead are dynamic and growing. A network consists of a set of entities, called variously units or neurons. But these entities can be anything from crickets to blog posts to bloggers themselves. In a network, these entities operate autonomously and are only tenuously connected. As the slogan goes, small pieces, loosely joined. They receive input from other entities to which they are connected, organize that input, and then pass it on. Or as the slogan goes, aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward. As I said, networks are dynamic. Connections come, connections go. A connection may be used a lot and grow stronger. It may be unused and grow weaker. Connections form for a variety of reasons. One way, one of the simplest, is Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb's principle of association. Two entities activated at the same time will tend to form connections with each other. Like attracts like. Clusters form, concepts emerge, and small worlds are created. The type of network I described just now, the network of connected educational blocks created by EduRSS, is a type of network called a neural network. As the name suggests, it's a network designed to emulate thought processes. Now, whether the brain itself is a type of neural network remains open to some debate. But as EduRSS illustrates, such a network can be developed to quite automatically obtain very specific results from very disorganized data. It is, quite literally, order out of chaos. So where does this position us with respect to learning and learning objects? The short answer is this. Alongside EduRSS, I've built a parallel system, the Distributed Learning Object Repository Network, or DLORN. It does exactly what EduRSS does, except that instead of harvesting RSS feeds from educational technology blogs, it harvests learning object metadata. It is, in essence, an end run around the federated search system, a way of collecting, recombining, and forwarding information about learning objects from a wide variety of sources. DLORN is much less developed than EduRSS. Most information about learning objects is locked away. We need a blogger of learning objects, a simple and useful authoring tool that lets staff and eventually students create their own learning resources to contribute to the common pool. And we need to rethink our definitions of learning objects to move beyond static concepts and start thinking about learning objects as resources generally, not just textbooks and tests. The long answer involves rethinking what it is when we think about offering learning online at all. Instead of offering classes and courses, learning online ought to be structured along the model of environments, games, or simulations. Writers like Seymour Papert and James Paul Gee have talked about this, so I need not review that part of the argument. What I do offer in this talk is a discussion of the means and mechanisms for importing learning specifically into those environments. Think of a learning environment as a space. If it is a space, it can be thought of as a layer. It is, ultimately, the output layer of the learning network I've just described. Corresponding to points in the space, like stars in the sky, are highly specific outputs of the learning network. Students, are the inhabitants who occupy this space. These outputs appear as features in their environment. Learning isn't something they go to. It isn't something they do. Learning is simply there. It's a feature of the environment to be used as needed. Think further of learning environments as a space, and it becomes clear that any space can become a learning environment. As access to the internet becomes ubiquitous, our internet connection follows us, is available at home, in our community, on the job. And it becomes clear that these output points may be located anywhere in the environment, whether that environment is Microsoft Word, a process control system, a grader, or a fishing rod. If, as I suggested above, we describe learning objects using the metaphor of language, text, sentences, and books, then the metaphor to describe the learning network I've just described is the ecosystem, a collection of different entities related in a single environment that interact with each other in a complex network of affordances and dependencies, an environment where the individual entities are not joined or sequenced or packaged in any way, but rather live, if you will, free. Their nature defined as much by their interactions with each other as by any inherent property in themselves. We don't present these learning objects ordered in a sequence. We present randomly, unordered. We don't present them in classrooms and schools. We present them to the environment, to where students find themselves, in their homes, in their workplaces. We don't present them at all. We contribute to the conversation. We become part of the conversation. They are not just texts and tests. They are ourselves, our blog posts, our publications and speeches, our thoughts and real-time conversation. Sigmund Freud leaning on the lamppost just when we need him. And if our words are worth hearing, they will become part of the common lingua franca, our culture and our knowledge, carried on in a new form through successive generations. We don't manage and control learning. We can't. We are but stewards. You may not have seen some of the things I've talked about in this paper, things like learning objects, learning management systems, content packaging, federated search and learning design, but if you haven't, you will soon. And you'll probably hear about them from a sales representative or a network administrator or supervisor. If you hear from your students, it would be about blogs and RSS, iPods and online games, or if they're honest, file sharing networks. And if the sales representative comes to you and tries to sell you an LMS, or worse, an LCMS, ask them why you have to pay so much money for something that the web and web browsers can do for free. And if the sales representative tries to sell you online courses and lessons, ask them whether it supports random access so students can use it when they want, even if they're not at school. Or ask them where you can access the dynamic feed with daily updated content. Or how easy it is to place images from the course content into your blog. If the sales representative tries to sell you learning design, ask for the open-ended improv version, the game outliner, the simulation editor. When he shows you the software, ask him where the student content goes in. Ask him to show you the blog aggregator. If you are asked to join a federated search network, ask the providers why they are afraid of the marketplace. What content are they keeping out? And where the third-party metadata, the evaluation and opinion, is. And when they speak of your students as human resources, knowledge workers, consumers, or target markets, ask the sales representative if he remembers when he was a child, his mind a little network, small and fragile, but open and free, an ecosystem ready and wanting to support a jungle of diversity and growth. Ask, above all, that our children be free. Thank you.